score gives us a chance to show a side of our country which is too often submerged. Our desire to live in peace, our desire to be of help. I hope in the coming months and years that many of you will follow the example of those who've gone before. They, I think, are serving this country well. And in a very real sense, they are serving a larger cause, the cause of freedom and the cause of a peaceful world. They are demonstrating their interest in people who may live on the other side of the globe, who may live in poverty and misery, but who, because of the presence of the Peace Corps, live in hope.
President John F. Kennedy encouraging the nation to join the Peace Corps when the program was still new. Now, the Peace Corps is having trouble attracting applicants. We'll find out how it's changing to encourage more people to join. But first, the peace is fragile in Afghanistan. The recent presidential runoff election there was riddled with fraud, and that threatened to break up the country. A last-minute deal was brokered by Secretary of State John Kerry, which he announced over the weekend.
Every single ballot that was cast will be audited 100%, all 8 million. This is the strongest possible signal by both candidates of a desire to restore legitimacy to the process and to Afghan democracy. With respect to national unity, both candidates have agreed to abide by the results of the audit and that the winner of the election will serve as president and will immediately form a government of national unity.
That deal came about after days of frantic maneuvering, as Carlotta Gall writes about in today's New York Times. Welcome to the program.
Thank you.
Well, first, thanks for being here, and let's set the scene. The presidential election runoff was held about a month ago between Ashraf Ghani and Abdullah Abdullah, and Ghani declared the winner, but Abdullah's supporters, they cry foul. And what are their objections?
Well, it's only preliminary results, so their objections are that, in fact, there are a lot of fraudulent ballots that have not been eliminated, and they want an audit on a certain number of those. And Mr. Ghani didn't agree to that, really, because the ones they were accusing of being fraudulent were mostly from areas that support him. So he pushed back, and eventually the only way they could resolve this was to actually audit every single ballot, which is going to be a huge operation, and I think still fraught with problems, similar to what we've seen. There's still a lot of tension, in fact, between the two parties, and we could still see a breakdown of the process because it's going to take weeks.
It's going to take weeks. And before this agreement was hatched and was signed, Germany raised an alarm and said, look, something's afoot here. Things are not going well in Afghanistan. United States, you need to do something. And then what happened?
Yes, well, they actually sent their ambassador up to warn a governor, a very powerful governor, who's a former Mujahideen commander up in the north, because they obviously heard that he was starting to rally people and talk about setting up a parallel government or declaring power. And it's really the northerners who support the presidential candidate, Dr. Abdullah, or Abdullah Abdullah, he's known as. They believe they've won, and they wanted to declare. So the Germans first got wind of this and tried to warn them that if you do that, we will pull out, there will be no more funding for you and no more help from our troops. Then the thing escalated very rapidly. He went ahead still and declared, we're ready to set up a parallel government. And then the Election Commission announced the preliminary results, which showed a massive jump for the other presidential candidate, Dr. Ashraf Ghani. That really exploded things because one side was celebrating for Mr. Ghani, but the other side was absolutely furious because they really believe they've won. And there is no doubt that both sides have used fraud, but the fraud is enormous. And so it could change the result. In fact, if the fraud was really checked, this is what observers are telling us. So the cat was set among the pigeons, and then Dr. Abdullah had a rally the day after that announcement of the preliminary results, and members of his supporters wanted to march on the palace, the presidential palace, and take control of ministries. They have a lot of sympathizers in the ministries. They felt they could do it. And Dr. Abdullah only just managed to hold them back. And it was because he'd received a phone call from President Obama that morning, at 6 in the morning, really warning him off doing anything, using violence or doing anything that was outside the Constitution. And that warning was enough to, I think, hold Abdullah back. He was basically told, hold on for 3 days. Secretary John Kerry will come and help mediate. And so he held off his supporters with that promise that in 3 days we are going to get something. But he had a great difficulty, and he was really isolated and had to leave the stage almost in tears. So very dramatic and very nervous moments. It was clear for all the diplomats here. The thing was at a total deadlock, but there was also a great fear that it would actually turn to violence.
Wow. And so you write in today's paper that this was perhaps as tumultuous a 6-day stretch for Afghanistan as any since the invasion of 2001. And so when Kerry arrived, Secretary of State John Kerry arrived on Friday and then engaged in conversations with both sides, was it really his presence that saved the day, if you will?
I think so, yeah, because he's obviously been here a lot, and he knows both the characters, and he knows President Karzai. He was here negotiating, you know, a fraudulent election 5 years ago when Karzai was up against Dr. Abdullah. So he knew all the characters, and he knew the scene, and I think he could step in knowledgeably quite quickly. And he also had this great leverage of, you know, the United States still has troops here and could pull out everything. But what was amazing was that the two sides were absolutely at deadlock and not talking. And so he had to shuttle between them, you know, and then they brought them to the embassy and they had them in different rooms. And then he had to shuttle to President Karzai, who is actually also involved in this because he appointed the election commission and they are the ones that are accused of doing a lot of the fraud. So it was really it was a three-way discussion for a lot of the time. And I think Mr. Kerry really did actually manage to bring some agreement. He basically said, I've only got 2 days. I've got to get to Vienna for other important talks, and we've got to stop this going too far. And they both realized that. And so the last hour, he got a deal. And now they're talking. They met today. Just the two of them. Dr. Abdullah went to Mr. Ghani's house. So Kerry really did get the thing back on track. It was an exciting week, certainly, for us.
Yeah. And so, as you say, we'll see how long that will hold and what will transpire in the coming weeks.
Yes, I think it's still a very fraught, intense difficulty because it's a great rivalry and there's a lot of at stake. And both men think they've won. So it's a tricky moment for Afghanistan.
Carlotta Gall, correspondent for The New York Times in Kabul, thank you so much.
Thank you.
Well, speaking of Afghanistan, remember Army Sergeant Bo Bergdahl? He was called a hero, then a traitor, and a deserter. He was captured and held by the Taliban for 5 years, and he was freed 6 weeks ago, May 31st, in exchange for 5 Taliban suspects who were being held in Guantanamo. And now he's back on active duty in San Antonio, Texas. Joining me to talk about this is Sig Christensen. He's senior reporter for the San Antonio Express News. Welcome.
Thank you.
So Bergdahl is back on active duty. What will he be doing?
They say he has an admin job. Now, it's hard to know what that means. Nobody's saying. As always, with this story, there are mysteries everywhere. So we don't know what kind of job it is he's doing. And we can only guess at his hours and who he even is reporting to. I wish they would tell us a little more. Frankly, the Army's been a bit squirrely on this to some degree because you can just imagine that things like that could be shared with the rest of us.
So he has also been going through a process of reintegration. And what has that entailed?
It entails a lot of talking, I think, above all else. The former prisoner is always encouraged to talk a lot about his or her captivity. And this program has been around a long time. They had three former hostages of the Colombian FARC. They had been kept in the jungle under prisoner of war status for 5 years. They were all contractors, and these three guys came back to San Antonio, and they went through this process where they talked about their captivity. They discussed the issues that they lived with, and then of course part of that reintegration involves slowly reacquainting them with life as a free human being. And then at some point, the former prisoners get to see their families. And in Bo Bergdahl's case, oddly, we don't have any reason to think that has happened.
That he hasn't seen his family yet.
We don't even know that he's talked to them. That's correct.
And how do you know that? How do you know he hasn't been in contact with them?
Well, we don't. That's what I'm saying. They have not said one way or the other. The spokesman for the family is Colonel Tim Marsano with the Idaho Army National Guard, and Tim has not said one way or the other what has happened. But there has been no indication that his parents came to Fort Sam Houston and met with him, and of course, they had waged a very public campaign on his behalf, and so now it's kind of odd. They've gone dark for whatever reason.
Well, the whole story, as you say, has been very strange. First, he was lauded as a hero, and now he's being seen, I guess, more skeptically. People are saying, well, no, he may have been a deserter. He may have put his fellow soldiers at risk. Maybe some died searching for him. And so now, how is he seen?
Well, it's interesting. Of course, he's gone off the post periodically, and Army South told me at one point that he had taken at least 10 trips off the post with his survival and evasion psychiatry team with him, and they talked about how he would even be congratulated. People would shake his hand. They would say, welcome back. They said that there had been no negative interactions with him at all, but needless to say, around the country, there have been negative reactions to it. Some people who served with him think that he deserted his post. Some said that he had been responsible for the deaths of soldiers that were looking for him. What the Army has said so far is that there's no evidence of misconduct. I don't know what that means. I just do, you know, I don't know whether they have decided that he did walk off his post or whether he was kidnapped. Even that part of the story hasn't been really made clear. So Just as I said at the start, there just are a million mysteries with this story. There is an Article 15-6 investigation that was done out there years ago by the commander at the time he disappeared, and nobody's seen a word of that. That would be a very interesting thing to read, and I've asked for it, and needless to say, the Army is not providing it.
And their reason for not providing it?
They haven't given one.
And they have released a few details. One, that he was, when he was held prisoner in Afghanistan, he was locked in solitary confinement for 2 straight years, didn't see another human face that entire time, and he was kept in a 6 by 6 foot metal box. And has that been corroborated?
No one has said a word about that. I don't know where that's coming from. One of the hallmarks of this story, outside of the persistent mysteries, is the fact that people in the Army who love to talk about supporting a person's privacy rights have periodically leaked things to the media, and that's one of those things that has been leaked by somebody. Nobody has officially said anything about that. It would not be unusual for the Taliban to put somebody in solitary confinement. They have certainly done that before. There were 3 journalists who were in Kabul when I was there in 2009, late in the year. They were kidnapped when they went to meet with the Taliban commander to do an interview, and then they were basically put in a hole, and I don't think they were treated very well. But that would be pretty typical of the way the Taliban handles prisoners.
Why would it be in the Army's best interest to keep information away from the media, from the public, about Sergeant Bergdahl, and to make it look like he was indeed treated really badly by the Taliban?
I don't know, but that's selective release of information. You know, nobody has come forward to say, what exactly happened that caused this incident to take place to begin with. Nobody knows how he managed to walk off or leave that post. That has not been discussed. So I'm always a little skeptical. I'm skeptical of the first reports that you see from media on anything. I'm skeptical of people saying that he got people killed, because I don't know that they actually know that. They sound like they're speculating. There's been a huge absence of information here, and the information that we are getting comes out in little bits and pieces. And, you know, it's a good football metaphor. If the guy is pushing you to the left, the play is going to the right. So I don't know what to think, except that I'm really hungry to know more at an official level at what happened here, because this story is so incomplete, it begs for a serious press conference at the very least.
Sid Christensen, senior reporter for the San Antonio Express News. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you.
Coming up, the culture of drones. They've been used in war, and now they're increasingly being used by civilians, such as architects. We're going to find out why next on Press Play.
Take KCRW with you on one of our smartphone apps. Available for the iPhone, Android, and BlackBerry, you can stream KCRW live, listen to podcasts, and all our news and music streams. Learn more and download at kcrw.com/apps.
This is Press Play. I'm Madeline Brand. Well, when you think of drones, what comes to mind? Military operations, spying, surveillance. Well, what about luxury hotels and apartment towers? A growing number of architects is exploring ways to use unmanned aerial vehicles to design buildings, some of them right here in Los Angeles. But they're also running into some unexpected ethical dilemmas along with that. KCRW's Frances Anderton is exploring the subject later today on her show DNA. It's a weekly show about design and architecture, and she's here now with a preview. Hi.
Hi, Madeline.
Okay, let's start with the Wilshire Grand Project, and this is billed as going to be the largest,
tallest tower in the West until another, yes, a taller one comes along, and it's being built by A.C. Martin. That's the firm that goes back many decades, venerable firm, built City Hall, built the Department of Water and Power, now building this massive tower, going to be upwards of 70 stories. And the principal, David Martin, who's the design partner, and his cousin, Chris Martin, also a partner at the firm, they decided it would be interesting to test out a drone. Chris Martin happens to be a pilot. They bought this little baby-ish drone. They got some of the younger staffers in their firm that kind of could figure out how to operate it. They went down to the Wilshire Grand site. They sent it up in the air. The as yet not existing Wilshire Grand
building. It's just a hole in the ground.
It's a very big hole in the ground that they are now putting concrete into. But they sent this drone up to get a sense of what might be the views. So if you're considering staying or living on the 35th floor, what might you see when you're on the 35th floor?
So they send up this drone, and what? They see these amazing views, unobstructed views.
They see amazing views, unobstructed views. They fly it around, so they get a sense of what might be the panoramas. They're also working on another project, actually, just a little bit south in downtown, which is at an even earlier stage than the Wilshire Grand. They sent the drone up at Wilshire Grand after it had been designed. They are now on another project, which is in the process of being designed. So they can now use this view information in a more, I guess they can actually apply it to their design thinking. Now, David will caution that there are already amazing technologies out there. For example, Google Earth, from which you can already get an extraordinary sense of what's out there that one couldn't have harnessed 50 years ago. Also, helicopters can go up. An architecture firm can hire a helicopter and its pilot to go up and take photos. So David will say, on the one hand, this is amazing, but he sees, however, a major ethical concern.
I'll tell you the downside. It became very apparent when from this parking lot, we flew this device up and there's a group of existing residential towers down there. Well, this thing could go look at any particular apartment, you know, from 20 feet away or 10 feet away and see how people are living.
Right. But what's the difference really between that and someone in the next tower over looking in with binoculars or with a telescope?
Well, that's a very good question. And there isn't much difference. I suppose, though, where there is a difference is if you live in a tower and you look across the tower opposite you, you have an idea of how many apartments might be able to look into yours. You have there is a sort of sense of boundaries. With a drone, you could go up in front of every single building and check out every single window. And you could look, where are the single women living that we could spot undressing or whatever one might be looking for, expensive stuff that one might try and steal, whatever it is, you know. So I think that I suppose the answer to that question is with the drone just gives you that much more ability to capture more. And there was an instance of this that happened in Seattle about 3 weeks ago where a woman living in a tower in Seattle was undressing and she did towards her window and see this drone at the window. And then she photographed it and she called the police and it went out into the community.
I can't imagine how shocking that would be just to see this thing.
Just see this thing peering at you. And in fact, this drone this drone operator had been hired by a developer who was checking out the views. And they actually went and apologized to this woman. But but let's just say, it's a little iffy.
Icky,
and David Martin is very interesting about it because he raises the pros, but he also raises the cons. And he says, you know, every new technology brings with it questions. And these ones are not yet resolved.
Well, architects are also using drones attached to 3D printers now, which is interesting. And tell us about that.
Well, this is very early stage. But another large firm in LA is a firm called Gensler. And Gensler has, in fact, invested in three of its younger designers. It's given them the time and support to test the possibility of 3D printing from a drone. The idea being that 3D printing is all the rage. It's about as much the rage as drones are becoming the rage. These people are thinking of putting the two together because 3D printers are limited in how much you can actually build. They're limited by the size of the 3D printing machine. So the concept is you attach the printer piece of the 3D printer to a drone, you send it up in the air, and basically, ultimately, down the line, you build the building, you spew out the building. Obviously, it's quite far-fetched for now, except as one of the designers at Gensler, Tam Tran, told us.
MIT has been the forefront of autonomous drones. They already have a drone that can take bricks and lay on top of each other in a very designed pattern.
Hmm. So this is drones and robotics coming to. This is typically drones currently in civilian use and largely in militaries are used for photographing stuff. They're used to surveil. What's going on in some of the architecture research is using drones to make something, to build.
Fascinating. And so brave, new worldish. And yet they are right here. It's happening now. In fact, right here at KCRW, it's happening because we have our own drone, I found out.
Yeah, we all found out with some surprise. Like, yeah. We have a drone. Why do we have a drone?
Why do we have a drone?
Well, we have a drone because we increasingly are photographing our events. We used to be just radio, but now we do more and more and more events and we record those events and we put them online. And the idea was buy a drone that would go up and photograph the crowds. However, Gary Scott, our program director, is very aware that it's not quite as easy as it sounds. There's a whole bunch of implications surrounding the use of drones, even for civilian or even hobbyist purpose. So for Gary, he's determined we do some photography using this drone, but we also use it as a sort of conversation starter with our audience about how do we all feel about these drones.
There's a lot of questions just in that tiny little box of this little vehicle that we could use for a couple crowd shots that we thought we really want to explore that.
That's Gary Scott.
Gary Scott, our program director. Okay, so how do we explore that?
We are calling on our listeners to write to us. start by going to kcrw.com/drones. There you'll find all the programming that we've done across all our platforms on drones to date. And there's a place there where you can write to us and give us your thoughts, pro or con. Tell us about the complexity as you see it. If you're making one, using one, tell us about it.
And if you want to leave a voicemail, you can do so at 1-844-PRESS-PLAY or also on our Facebook page, KCRW Press Play. Francis Anderton hosting DNA. That's KCRW's show about design and architecture. You can hear the whole thing because this is just a tidbit today at 2:30. Thank you.
Thank you, Madeline.
Coming up, the toughest job you'll ever love, the Peace Corps. For decades, it's been a successful program that exposes Americans to other cultures and other cultures to the positive side of U.S. power. But now its enrollment is falling off. We're going to find out why after this news update with Eric Roy.
Listen to KCRW's 24-hour all-news channel. Stream BBC World Service, NPR, and KCRW programs. Continuous coverage and accessible via our smartphone app or online at kcrw.com.
This is Press Play. I'm Madeline Brand. The Peace Corps has been sending Americans overseas to do good works for half a century.
I have today signed an executive order providing for the establishment of a Peace Corps on a temporary pilot basis. I'm also sending to Congress a message opposing authorization of a permanent Peace Corps. This corps will be a pool of trained men and women sent overseas by the United States government or through private institutions and organizations to help foreign countries meet their urgent needs for skilled manpower. It is our hope to have between 500 to 1,000 people in the field by the end of this year.
That was President Kennedy back in 1961. At its height in 1970, the Peace Corps had more than 9,000 volunteers. Recently, though, it's been struggling. The number of Peace Corps volunteers is now the lowest it's been in a decade. So today, the organization announced it's making some changes. They're cutting the year-long application process in half and stepping up recruiting. New volunteers will also get to choose where they go. The moves might make service more attractive, but why has the Peace Corps lost so much cachet since it was created by President Kennedy? Elizabeth Cobbs Hoffman is a history professor at San Diego State and author of the book All You Need Is Love, The Peace Corps and Spirit of the 1960s. Welcome.
Thank you. Well, good to be here, Madeline.
Well, nice to have you. And the Peace Corps announced these changes today. And does it sound a lot different from the way things used to be? Are these dramatic differences?
Well, there are some dramatic differences. The Peace Corps has always been advertised as the toughest job you'll ever love, but it's also the toughest application you'll ever write. There's kind of been a long line. It took a year for people to get in, and that's kind of crazy, especially considering today's speed with which people can apply for almost anything. And so they're changing that, and I think it'll have a real impact.
And also choosing where you go, will that have an impact?
Oh, that's huge. It's always been the case that with the Peace Corps, you had no idea where you'd go. It was kind of potluck. And so you could apply for, you know, Africa and end up in, you know, somewhere in Poland. And so I think that that'll also make a big difference in people's desire to apply.
Well, let's take a step back and look at the beginning of the Peace Corps. It was created in 1961. And tell us about why he created it and what the purpose was from the United States point of view.
Well, the purpose from the United States point of view was, you know, there are several purposes. One was it was really a part of the Cold War in the sense that the United States wanted to present what it was about, not just what it was against. And Kennedy was very much into that notion that the United States should be making more positive efforts in the world and not simply efforts oriented around defense. He was also, as you may recall, his program is called the New Frontier. So this idea of asking people to conquer difficult things was a part of that. One reason why the application process was so hard is that they wanted to make it clear that, you know, you couldn't waltz into the Peace Corps. You had to be really dedicated.
And so it attracted a lot of idealistic young people in the 1960s and in the 1970s. And was it part of the peace movement? Were the people who were attracted to it people who were anti-war?
Well, at the time, it wasn't, when, especially in 1961, this wasn't the era yet of the Vietnam War, but these were people who were very idealistic, and Kennedy said, ask not what your country can do for you, but what you can do for your country, and he added, for the world, or what the United States could do for the world. And so the Peace Corps has always been a barometer of American idealism and optimism, and that was soaring in the early 1960s. In fact, it started to fall away in the late 60s and early 70s when Americans became disillusioned as a result of the Vietnam War and felt that maybe their country wasn't making the kind of positive contributions they hoped it would.
So the Peace Corps was seen as part of that whole tragedy in our foreign adventures?
In a way, it got mixed up in it more than anything else. I think that one of the things that's always been a part of the Peace Corps' charm and durability is that it appears in a very bipartisan way to American ideals. And so some of its strongest supporters have been Republicans, like George H.W. Bush, the first President Bush, who, in fact, was involved in helping to start the U.N. Peace Corps, where actually they were called U.N. volunteers. So it's always appeared to appeal to idealism on the left and also on the right, you might say. But it certainly got stuck in the mud of Vietnam to some extent.
And President Nixon was not a big fan of it, I understand.
Oh, no, not a fan. he was very cynical and became very cynical about American young people, especially any folks who were associated with campus protest in the Vietnam, the Peace Corps was to some extent. And so really, if Watergate had not gotten to Nixon, Nixon might have gotten to the Peace Corps. He was secretly planning with his top aides to cut the budget of the Peace Corps and, as he said, get rid of it, get rough.
And so let's fast forward to now, and I wonder if you could talk a little bit about how it's seen by young people today. I mean, I keep hearing stories that young people now are more idealistic than previous generations. Why aren't they attracted to the Peace Corps?
Well, I do think we have a wonderful generation of young people coming up. And I am a university professor, so I see young people all the time. And it's just inspiring and exciting how this generation has really taken up the idea of doing good things in the world. But the Peace Corps has seen a slide between 2009 and 2013 in the number of applicants. So the process for applying hasn't changed. What did change in those years was the American economy. And so I think what we're seeing is the results of the Great Recession, if you will. Peace Corps has always been sensitive not only to American optimism and idealism, but also to economic circumstances. When it started, the Kennedy folks recognized that it was harder for working-class young Americans to consider volunteering for the Peace Corps than it was for comfortable middle-class or upper-middle-class Americans, for the simple reason that they knew that they needed, these particular young people needed to get serious early on about what they were going to do with their careers and how they were going to support themselves. And so it's entirely likely that this slide in the last 4 years is very much tied to economic circumstances. It's great, however, that they are going to shorten up this application process, because that's kind of crazy. I mean, you can know within 2 or 3 months through the early registration processes whether you get into Stanford or Harvard. So it shouldn't take a year to find out if you can get into the Peace Corps.
So it was seen as something as a luxury to go away for 2 years and volunteer your services. What about on the other end? How do countries on the receiving end of these volunteers, how do they rate the Peace Corps?
I traveled a lot. I wrote a book on the history of the Peace Corps called All You Need Is Love. And one place that took me to, for example, was Ghana in Central West Africa, which was the first country to have Peace Corps volunteers and still does. And it was just moving and remarkable to talk with people at all different levels in Ghana, from government bureaucrats down to people selling art on the street. Who would say, oh my gosh, I had a Peace Corps volunteer who was my teacher. And so it's quite interesting that the feedback has always been very strongly positive on the Peace Corps from the receiving countries. I mean, by the way, these Peace Corps volunteers go in and change the whole life of the country any more than if somebody sent 100 volunteers to the United States. But at the same time, it's very remarkable. These people are young people are really seen.
But is it effective? Are they doing anything that is going to change, bring change for the long term and bring a lot of change.
Well, it's it depends on what you mean by change. You were just having a show about drones, for example, or Afghanistan. The United States has created some really big change in some other places that's been really remarkable, and sometimes it's been good and sometimes it's been bad. What the Peace Corps does is a much more grassroots kind of change. And one of the things it does is not only change other countries to some extent in minor modest ways, but it brings change back to the U.S., and that was part of Kennedy's vision as well, was that this would change our people and allow people to come back and live their lives in more useful ways as citizens. There's a remarkable percentage of Peace Corps volunteers who go into government, who go into teaching, who enrich our vision of what our country is about. And so that's a part of the change that the Peace Corps, I think, has always brought.
Well, thanks a lot for joining us.
Thank you.
That's Elizabeth Cobbs Hoffman, history professor at San Diego State University. She wrote a book called All You Need Is Love, The Peace Corps and Spirit of the 1960s. Let's now get a firsthand take on the Peace Corps and what it's like to be a volunteer. Jessie Beck is on the line now. She went to Madagascar with the Peace Corps from 2011 to 2013. Welcome.
Hi.
Well, why did you want to join the Peace Corps?
To be completely honest, I'm not sure what the original inspiration was. I've been wanting to join since high school, but when I finished university, which was in 2009 at the height of the recession, I decided to go abroad and teach English. Wasn't too thrilled with the structure of that program, or non-program rather, mm-hmm. and decided that I wanted to keep on teaching English and decided to go for the Peace Corps instead. And
And so you did. And how was your experience? You were there for 2 years. Do you feel that you were changed by it, as President Kennedy envisioned?
Me personally, definitely changed by it. And I would always describe my service in the Peace Corps as 2 years with some of the strongest positives and also some of the strongest negatives and challenges that I've ever faced. So it was definitely this mood swing of like really great and rewarding experiences, and then also these very low moments where you just don't know if you're ever going to finish Peace Corps, if this is really something that you should have done. And that's generally how I describe
it. What were some of the most challenging moments for you? Can you describe them?
Madagascar is a very undeveloped nation. It's very far removed from the world. So unlike some volunteers who may have gone to Central America or Caribbean, you are essentially on the other side of the world from your family. So that alone is pretty difficult to deal with. Not every volunteer went home during that service because it just was financially prohibiting. It's also very basic conditions of life. I had no running water, but I did have electricity. Buses took forever to get anywhere. It was just a very basic style of living. Sometimes it was kind of frustrating, or things just took longer, or you couldn't get done what you wanted to get done that day. And those are blows that you're supposed to expect in the Peace Corps, but nonetheless challenging.
Right, right. And so do you think that you made a difference?
In small ways. I don't think any volunteer abroad can go for 2 years and completely turn around the economic or environmental or educational situation of a community. But we do make impacts in ways that we may not see while we're there, and which may not be as obvious as building a new school or something. It might just be influencing somebody to study in university or to keep on with their English learning or something like that. But we won't know about that.
Mm-hmm. And so now that you've returned, how has being in the Peace Corps affected you in terms of your life and the career you're going to pursue and what you're going to do with your life?
So currently I work for a website called Go Overseas, and we are basically a resource for anyone who wants to volunteer, teach, or study abroad. And being a Peace Corps volunteer has been very pivotal in helping me get to this point in my career, and also just sort of being an advocate for people who want to teach abroad, and also blogging and writing content about quote-unquote meaningful travel abroad, like Peace Corps and teaching ESL.
And what do you think of the changes? Do you think that's a good idea to change it so you get to choose where you go, that the application process is less onerous?
I So I read up about this earlier this morning and saw that there's a lot of controversy, people who don't agree with it and people who do agree with it. Personally, I really like the idea of having a shorter application process because there was a lot of my life that I had to put on hold during that year-plus period. And as far as being able to choose your country, that sounds very appealing. And I know that there's so many other volunteer opportunities out there that if you can choose to volunteer abroad with a very similar organization as Peace Corps in the country that you definitely want to go to, then you might opt for that program rather than Peace Corps. Personally, though, I really like to be sort of, you don't know where you're going, so you're just going to go somewhere. I found that kind of exciting, and not everyone does.
All right. Jessie Beck, she went to Madagascar with the Peace Corps from 2011 to 2013. Now she works for GoOverseas.com and blogs at BeatNomad.com. Thank you for joining us.
You're welcome. Thank you.
And we want to hear your Peace Corps stories. Did you volunteer? What was your experience like? What do you think the Corps could do to attract more applicants? Join the conversation on our Facebook page. We're at KCRW Press Play. All right, Warren Olney is here now, not volunteering here in the studio.
Well, I am volunteering. I mean, I would be volunteering if I weren't getting paid for it. Let's put it that way. I'm happy to be here. I really am. I always am. We all loved the World Cup and enjoyed a lot of the games. But the aftermath in Brazil is not entirely pretty. We're going to talk a little bit about that. It might even have an impact on the president's reelection campaign in October. Remember, they had protests with a million people in the streets a year ago.
Yeah.
And that might happen again.
Okay, look forward to that discussion. 1 o'clock, To the Point with Warren Olney. And coming up on this program, Brain Power. The U.S. and Europe want to spend billions to map our brains. We'll find out where that's headed next on Press Play.
This podcast is produced by KCRW, a nonprofit public radio station based in Los Angeles. We rely on listeners like you. Support the podcasts you love by becoming a member. Go to kcrw.com/join.
This is Press Play. I'm Madeline Brand. It appears Europe and the United States are in a battle of the brains. A year and a half ago, the EU announced the Human Brain Project, a billion-dollar initiative to map the mysteries of the human brain. And then, a few months later, President Obama proposed an American version. It's called the Brain Research Through Advancing Innovative Neurotechnologies Initiative, a mouthful, but it's an acronym, BRAIN. Brain. But the secrets in your skull may not be unlocked anytime soon. The American scheme might end up getting snared in Washington's partisan gridlock. And across the Atlantic, about 600 prominent scientists are protesting the European project. Jonathan Webb is a science reporter for the BBC who's been following this story. He also happens to have a PhD in neuroscience from Oxford. So welcome.
Thanks, Madeline.
So that was a little dramatic, the intro, in terms of the battle of the brains. But is there really a competition going on?
Well, yeah, I appreciate the drama, but not really. It seems that, certainly according to the leaders of the two projects, they're pretty complementary. They have slightly different aims. The US initiative is more aimed at developing new technologies to do experiments and to try and map the way that all of the different brain cells and circuits in the brain interact with each other, whereas the one in Europe is aimed at computing mostly. So they want to build a new generation of supercomputers and use that to compile all of the data that we've got about the way the brain works and then start trying to simulate the way it does some of the different jobs it does.
So there has been some backlash to the project in Europe, and what's behind that?
Well, it seems to be largely a question of management. There are a lot of neuroscientists, some of whom were involved in the project and either have been sort of left out of the next phase or have withdrawn, and a lot who are external to the project who are concerned about partly all the resources that are being poured into the Human Brain Project, but in particular, because of the large amount of resources, they want to be more involved in having a say in the way that the project's governed and the direction that it takes. And they're seem to be worried that it's sort of quite closed. It's a little bit opaque and hard to know exactly what's going on. And if they have a disagreement with the direction of the project, they're worried that it's not being heard.
And here in the States, there hasn't been that kind of backlash.
Not to the same extent. I'm sure there are just as, I mean, science is a vibrant debate, you know, at the best of times. And I'm sure there are people having very vigorous discussions about different details of the project. But it seems overall that it's been received a bit more positively by the community over there. The size of this petition in Europe, it's now up to nearly 600 signatures from neuroscientists. And some of them are quite big names. So overall, it seems like it has gone down a little bit better in the US than in Europe.
And so why is this necessary now? Aren't there other research initiatives going on throughout the world trying to unlock these, neuroscience mysteries?
There certainly are. And that's one of the disagreements that's happening in Europe at the moment, is whether or not this big central project should be attracting so much funding because it's very different, right? In biological and biomedical science, we're much more used to smaller grants going to individual projects instead of these big coordinated initiatives. Things like physics are maybe much more used to that because they've had to build things like big colliders and so on. But there is certainly a lot of other research going on, but scientists both in the US and in Europe argued that it was time for a big investment to try and answer some of the bigger questions about the brain.
Well, there was the Human Genome Project, which was partially funded by the government, or mostly funded by the government. Is that analogous?
That comparison has been made. A lot of people would argue that the Genome Project had a simpler and clearer aim because it was just about finding all of those letters, finding the A's, G's, C's and T's that were in our DNA. It was a sort of a fairly straightforward, although at the time very challenging, technical project. The brain initiatives are a little bit trickier to define in terms of what it will mean when they're finished and what it will mean if they're successful.
And why is that?
Probably because the brain science field is in an arguably earlier stage. So we don't know exactly what's going on at the cellular level throughout the brain. We know the way that different components interact to do certain tasks. But in terms of building up any kind of large-scale simulation or model of exactly how the whole thing works, we're a long way off. So if that was the aim, as opposed to finding our whole genome, it's a much, much more distant proposition.
So much more difficult to figure out what's going on in there,
yeah, exactly.
In the head. And what are the main questions, though, that scientists want to answer when it comes to how the brain functions?
Well, we want to know what's going on inside our heads. And in particular, in people, you know, when the brain's working perfectly, when it's working well. But we want to understand what happens when it's not working well, when there are neurological diseases or when there are mental health problems. So a lot of neuroscience is driven by trying to understand those sort of medical problems. But then there are also people who are just curious about trying to work out how this amazing organ works. And there are almost too many questions to answer, really. But the initiative in Europe is trying to kind of model what's going on, and the one in America is trying to map the way everything fits together.
And what are the roles of companies, private companies, drug companies, technology companies in this competition or in this idea to map the brain? Are they actively interested in pouring money into it?
That's a very interesting point. They don't seem to have expressed a great deal of interest so far, and that would probably be one of the arguments for why brain science is at a relatively immature stage. You would think if there were immediate implications in terms of making drugs and fixing diseases that the drug companies and other commercial interests would get involved. But in terms of these big initiatives, as far as I'm aware, most of it is research council type funding.
So what do you think? Do you think either project is going to go forward full steam ahead, or is this just a good idea that maybe we might fund in the future, but who knows?
Yeah, I'd like to think they'd both go full steam ahead. You're right that there are questions over the degree to which they're going to be funded. But I think it's good to have grand, ambitious projects, and in particular in these biomedical sciences where there haven't always been such big sort of attention getting central coordinated initiatives. And I would like to think they will both go ahead. What's tricky is to know whether they will meet the aims that they've set out, because it's hard to know. It's, as I said, very different from spelling out the genome. What does it mean when we've, you know, solved the brain? I think actually getting a really detailed understanding of how all of the different cells in the brain work is probably a long way off. But I'd like to think that these big projects with all of the smart people involved, we'll probably get some really crucial insights inside the next 10 or 20 years for sure.
Jonathan Webb, science reporter for the BBC, thank you.
No worries at all.
Andrew Walsh is here now with the feedback.
I am filling in for Jolie Myers again. And by the way, great show today.
Thank you to yourself.
No, you do all the work. I really like the conversation about the Peace Corps, and we were asking the press players to share their stories about their time volunteering in the Corps, and we heard from Peter. He trained English teachers in Turkmenistan from 2010 to 2012, and he says that the Peace Corps had a large impact on his life. He met his wife there. He learned self-reliance and fortitude, and he likes most of the changes that they're considering to the application process, except the ability to choose the countries to serve in. He says he would have never chosen Turkmenistan, but now that he has been there, he's really happy that he ended up there. We also heard from Saskia, a PhD candidate at UCLA who served in Tonga, and she said that the Corps should get rid of the bureaucratic red tape we were talking about, but they should not make the application process too easy.
I think that the application process should not be shorter in terms of the essays. They really need a rigorous screening of candidates' potential and personality. But the long wait in the bureaucracy really hinders who joins. So great potential volunteers are going to have many other options, including med school, PhD programs, nonprofit work. And the uncertainty of the process just loses a lot of those applicants.
Really briefly, you guys were also talking about drones with DNA host Frances Anderton. And as she told you, KCRW just purchased its own drone. And she's been asking listeners to help come up with a good name for the drone. And I think that there are some good suggestions. Snoopy is my favorite so
That's
far.
That's a great one.
Skylab, Radio Eyes, Not a Tote Bag, which is a little cumbersome, but I get it. And then my suggestion, if I had to throw one in there, would be Busby. It's got your kind of cultural kind of,
Busby Berkeley?
But I always picture drones as buzzing around.
Interesting. Okay. Well, if you have an idea, I like Snoop Dogg. Anyway,
That's
a good one, right? Oh, I have a few seconds left. You can leave your idea on our Facebook page. KCRW's Press Play. I'm Madeline Brand. Thank you, Andrew Walsh. Warren Olney, To the Point. Up next, a few beats of music, and goodbye.